What's up, OUXers? In this episode, I talked to the VP of Design and Research at HelloFresh, Jake Zukowski. We talk about how a designer on his team started sneaking in OUX through the back door, and he noticed that this particular designer was just asking all the right questions and providing super insightful work. Shout out to Erica Queen. And this made him get curious about this whole OUX thing. So he went on the internet and started looking into it, and he'll tell that story in the episode. But this basically gave him the impetus to enroll 10 members of his team into the OUX Masterclass, creating a team cohort. So we're going to talk about that story, as well as fun, geeky things like object states and the roles of product managers and product owners and UX designer roles and so much more. So if you're listening and you lead a team and want to get your team on board with OUX, go to OUX.com/team cohorts to see how much you actually get and save when you enroll a whole group. So you get major discounts. Yay! Plus you get private office hours with me, and you get some guidance on how to run an internal cohort. I mean, it's not that complicated, but I still help you out to just keep everybody accountable and keep everybody in sync. And here's the thing. So I have a secret motive here. I want to get more product managers and product owners on board with OUX and Orca. So if you're a PM or a PO and you're listening, okay, when you sign up for the course, use discount code OUXPM10 for 10% off. And this is going to apply to team cohorts too. So discounts on top of discounts. All right. Please, on your honor, just use this discount code if you are a PM or a PO, and if you're signing yourself up as well. All right. So this discount will expire on May 15th, 2023. All right, so that's OUX.com/team cohorts, or if it's just you signing up, OUX.com/masterclass, and that discount is OUXPM10. All right, let's jump into the conversation. Welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head-on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of Object-Oriented UX, and your host. Let's jump into it. What's up, OUXers? I have a real treat for you today. I'm very excited to welcome Jake Zukowski, or Jake
Zukowski.
Zukowski.
Yeah. Depends.
Polish pronunciation.
You're much more Polish than I am, even though I've got the name.
I am. I would like to be more Polish. I'm trying to learn Polish in an object-oriented way. Maybe that's for another. Applying OUX to language learning. Of course I am. It's just the goggles. It's the goggles that I see the world in, and I am self-aware of that. So, Jake, you are a badass. You are the Vice President of Global Research and Design at HelloFresh, and you are currently enrolled in the self-paced masterclass, the OUX self-paced masterclass, along with quite a few people on your team in what we like to actually call a team cohort. So I just want to ask, I'm just curious, how's the course going so far?
So far, so good. I can tell exactly where everyone is on the course based upon what I see in critique. So I have a handful of designers that are definitely knee deep in object requirements, which is where I'm at too. Okay. That's a hard unit, by the way.
Object requirements or relationship requirements? Object requirements is the object guide. Which should be, I mean, defining things is hard, right? Defining things is very hard. It's a lot of writing.
Words have meaning. That's why it's hard for me.
They do. But defining things is so important.
It gets worse
before it gets better. It does get worse before it gets better. So the object guide is that glossary on steroids. And sometimes I even say that is like, if you do one thing in the entire 15-step Orca process, create a glossary. Just make a glossary of your terms, especially your objects, and get really clear on that and shop it around and make sure everybody in the organization is just using the same words for the same things. Just do that. But you'll get into relationship requirements next. And that's where we that's where I shove in inheritance. So inheritance really could start earlier on. It's just it's advanced requirements kind of, advanced relationships. So we get into inheritance and we get into my cat saving fire department, which stands for mechanics, cardinality, sorts, filters, and dependencies. And you look at that for every nested object. So
I am excited.
It's fun.
And I will tell you here's a life hack. This is almost becoming, a bit patent saying now. So what I have done is I have gone to ChatGPT and when writing these object requirement guides, at least for my own studying, I take your template and paste it in there to say I need to write this. Here is the template of how to do this. And then I just write a bunch of bullets of the object stuff. ChatGPT knows how to get requirements out. You wouldn't believe. And I was like, I never even thought about that. Whoa. It's amazing.
Whoa. That's super cool. Maybe we'll do a little video of that at some point.
I really want
to see that happen. That's really neat. Don't ask ChatGPT to define OAUX though, because it's wrong.
What does it say? Do you know?
It basically says it's defining all the components. And I'm like, no, components and objects, those are different. Those are different. If you replace component and object, I don't know. Maybe it's not learning right now because it's all taking data from 2021 and before. So I don't think it's learning yet.
It's confused about design systems again. You know, everyone else is. They get confused. A design system, so UX, you're like, no.
Yes. So it's really that confusion around are we organizing components? Are we organizing the implementation of the thing? Are we organizing the concepts behind? Are we organizing the packaging? Are we organizing the stuff that goes in the packaging? And
exactly
that latter, the stuff that goes in the packaging, is that's the object-oriented UX part of
it. No one's coming to your website for your calendar picker. This is what I hear.
No, they're not. They need to use it. They need to touch that calendar picker. Sure, but that's not what they're coming to do. Cool. So, and just for anybody who is interested, if you are interested in doing a team cohort like Jake and his team are doing, you can go to oaux.com/team cohorts and you get bulk rate, group rate discounts. And you also get office hours with me thrown in. And y'all have a lot of office hours because you got 10 people signed up. So y'all need to book some office hours soon.
And no, and this doesn't even count. I'm already getting free office hours. It's a podcast. I love it.
Oh,
I just keep
getting
those office hours.
I feel like I'm getting office hours with you though right now.
Aww,
actually.
That's very sweet.
So you need to book some office hours with me, with your team, especially since you're getting into requirements and maybe relationship requirements would be a really good time.
I think so.
To book some Q&A with me because it's dicey.
Absolutely. One thing that your audience might be interested in is how did a dumb vice president of design come to buy 10 seats for a cohort like this? And how did the discovery come here? Because I think a lot of folks have some questions around once they learn this process, how do you get it integrated into a business? And at HelloFresh, I think the last time I counted, we're 87 designers and UX writers and researchers worldwide. And that's a big scope. And how do you get to, instead of just telling the team or telling your design leader, why this is important, how did this come about at HelloFresh? So for me, I believe we had one person who went through the OUX program, but never, ever, ever told anyone that she was doing it. But what ended up happening was she was put on projects and all of a sudden, the stuff that she was doing was much more the depth of thought was there, the complexity was there. She understood, she's part of our business, but she understood the business kind of better than any other designer understood the business because I think she knew what the right questions to ask. And eventually, while I'm in critique with her, it's just me and the senior vice president of product are in critique with her. We're like, Jesus Christ, this is great work, my God. And I keep seeing this thing that's this is an object-oriented approach. This is OO approach or something like that. And then eventually one day, without her prompting, I was like, what does this mean? And I just typed in object-oriented design approach. And then I found you. And of course, you can't tell a vice president of design, you need to go do this. They have to go find it on their own. And so when I found it on my own and I started devouring your materials, right? So I read through all of the free stuff, started listening to the podcast, and I was like, oh my God, this is all of the stuff that I was kind of trying to do even back in my designer days, back in 2008, when I was like redesigning Microsoft's customer care software. Horrible problem. And I, again, like, I wish that I would have had this material back then. And I was like, oh, I can see this. I can see this. And so then I was like, well, I've got budget. I've got 10 souls that want to learn. I gave them a little bit. I kind of dipped the fishing line in and I said, like, look, this costs a certain amount of money. I'll pay this much. You pay this much if I get 10 of you. And then all of a sudden they were like, ugh. And I gave them like, you have to do these things as part of this. You have to be a cohort together. You have to hold each other accountable. And they're doing it. And I love it.
It's such an amazing success story. And can we give that lovely lady who was doing underground OUX, a secret OUX, can we give her a shout out? Who was that?
Sure. Erica Queen. Erica Queen, my OG Erica Queen.
Erica Queen, shout out to you. I recognize your name. I've seen you in the Slack channel. So thanks for bringing OUX to HelloFresh. And I'm so glad, like, I was definitely going to ask you this question. I'm so glad you just jumped right into it, because this is one of the main questions that I get with folks that are, you know, mid-level UX, senior level UX designers, also content strategists as well, that are getting really excited about object-oriented UX. And they don't know how to bring it in. And sometimes they come in kind of because they're all excited about it. So they come right in, like, they come in hot and they're like, we must now become an OOUX organization. And they're like, we need to start doing things completely differently. And we'll probably get into process a little bit and how things have potentially changed. But the more and more that I'm hearing stories like yours, and you just said it so well, I'm more and more advising people to just start using it. Don't ask for permission.
Correct.
Just use it as a tool for understanding, asking really great questions, and you will be noticed. It will start. It might take 6 months. It might take 6 months. It might just take 6 weeks. It might take 6 days. And folks will start asking, especially if you're like showing that object map. I think she showed you an object map. And this is exactly what I say. I kind of say to use reverse psychology a little bit, like just show the object map and just be like, oh, this is just a tool, just a little tool that I use to make sure I've got all the requirements straight. You don't need to worry about it.
Yeah. Well, one of the biggest problems we have at HelloFresh is designing for, because we're a subscription service, we've got kind of two different objects that have these multitude of states in them, and they can cause so many problems because you don't think through all of the complexity of all this. So a delivery can have 8 different states to it. A customer on any given delivery can have 3 different states. And so right off the bat, like, we could ask people to do 24 wireframes for every single state, you know, and like there's some that don't make sense, but like asking a designer to do 24 different wireframes or showing through an OUX process that you understand all of this and that how these things start to flow in well before you do UI has been incredibly powerful and such a game changer for HelloFresh. We're already starting to see the benefits coming out of it.
I mean, also you have recipes have states too. So like, have you had this recipe before? Has like in these relative states too, like relative to the end user. So a Correct. Recipe could probably have states within your company. Like, is this an active recipe? Is this a new recipe? Is this a sunsetted archived recipe? And then for the end user, you have like, have I made this before? How many times have I made this? Is this recipe on the way? Or do I have this recipe in my house right now? You might call them meals/recipes, right? And then we could get into what's the difference between a meal and a recipe, which could potentially have differences. But like when you start combining that, when you have the 8 different states of the delivery, then you have states within the delivery of recipes within, and then within that, you also have who's getting this box
right
with the recipes in it. Like, my math isn't that good to say like how many permutations that is and how many wireframes that mean.
Yeah. Never do math live. It's a terrible, terrible idea.
Especially like multiplication. Like that.
Oh yeah. No.
You know, we're not going to do that. But it's a lot.
We're designers. We can't do multiplication. My God.
It's triple digits. I think we're going to be getting into triple digits there when you like think about all those states. And if you add one more object, which I'm sure you've got, like ingredients, right? Like, are ingredients in stock or not in stock? You know.
Oh.
Does the person want to say that they have that in their house? Do they have olive oil? Maybe we don't need to send them olive oil because they always have it at their house. Like,
or we send them pantry items. So like, we can also send pantry items. So there's a whole thing around like what's called market items and add-ons. The whole thing is kind of crazy. What I would say is tweet at me and Sophia, if you've done the math, let us know. I would love to know what you came up with the number of states.
I love that. Yes.
You bring up this excellent point because not only do we have a customer facing aspect to our digital product in our business, but I think what's even more important is all of the back-end tools and all the back-end processes and everything that you're bringing up. The most excitement from Erica's kind of seed work that she did at HelloFresh really hit our enterprise experience team the most. And they're like, I have so much complexity that I have to put in front of buyers, merchandisers, pick and pack folks, like all of the people that support the HelloFresh service. So I would say that even if you are looking at this from a B2C perspective, those experiences, like the B2B designers were the ones that understood that, like, I need to get my hands around this complexity really, really quick.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yes. I mean, like any kind of, I'm just thinking about like your supplier interface. Like, oh my gosh, I'm sure there's just so much complexity there. And wherever that complexity starts snowballing, like that's where OUX really shines. But I still apply it. Like if I am OUXing a page on OUX.com, which is basically like a simple marketing site, I'm still using object-oriented UX for the simplest thing. For what, if I'm dealing with one object or two objects, I'm like, I'm still going to map this out because I don't want to waste my time. I don't want to waste my time moving straight into wireframes.
Me too. My niece is an author and she has three books now, or she has two books and she's having third coming out soon. And we started doing OUX on her website after doing just plain old wireframes. And now I'm like, no, the book is an object. It has a short description, it has a long description. It has a CTA for the ebook and the physical book and like blah, blah, blah. And it's now turning into a product. I've done this work with my husband. And so my husband is the engineer while I'm the designer. And now all of a sudden he's like, oh, like he's also enjoying that the design process is more talking about like how we are implementing these things as opposed to just like kind of deconstructing wireframes and figuring out what the heck I'm talking about, even though we live in the same household.
So what does your husband think about OUX?
He thinks, I think what everyone feels when you get to object requirements, which is, this is a lot. And is there a time where we're going to narrow down? And I'm like, yeah. We're only on like step six of the, you know, five or six of the Orca process. He's like, how many steps are there? And I was like, 15, but like, don't worry about it. Yeah. And so he's looking forward to, like, we're in a different personal project. He's looking forward to kind of the narrowing aspects when we start getting into the next phases.
And I do have to say, what is coming? You have relationship requirements coming, CTA requirements coming, of course. And then attribute requirements is where you're going to get into all the good conditional logic and state stuff. So what we were talking about before with all the states, like we're going to cover that. It's coming. And then this is such a flexible process. A lot of folks will actually, if they're short on time, switch the prioritization round and the requirements round. So you kind of go through discovery and then you could go through like a quick and dirty prioritization to do that narrowing down and then really just think about requirements for the stuff that you've already narrowed down. And there's arguments both ways. Like sometimes I say like, well, you kind of need to really understand the stuff before you start prioritizing it. But you can definitely mix and match and move it around and skip steps and remix. So that is the thing that I think a lot of people like about the Orca process, which is objects, relationships, CTAs, and attributes for those that are new to the podcast and new to OUX. So the great thing about this like 15-step process is it's not really a 15-step process. It's 15 steps and it's like archetypical state, but it's so flexible and you don't even have to, you can do the okra process. Actually, that's a thing too. Yeah.
I love okra. It's delicious. And you're from the South. So
I
of course
am. The first vegetable I ever grew was an okra. If I ever get a tattoo, it's going to be an okra blossom. Cool. Yeah, they're great. They like open up in the morning and then close. They're just simple and beautiful. Maybe that would be like a good nod to, maybe I could do like an okra blossom with an orca whale, like somehow integrated. That would be a cool tattoo. That's my OUX tattoo if I ever get one.
And then a bar of almond roca, because we're just going to keep changing things around. So you need almond roca in there as well.
Is almond roca, is that a German
No.
Is that a, where, what
Isn't
is
it
roca?
isn't that an American candy?
Roca are
don't even worry about it.
Yeah, let's not worry about
don't
it.
Don't even worry about
but
it.
But there's probably other remixes too. So let's back up a little bit, because you were talking about, oh, I went back when you were in your designer phase. You wish that you had had this. I feel the same way. I'm like, oh my gosh, if I had had OUX on that first B2B Blue Cross Blue Shield project back in 2010, like that project would have been way more fun and way easier and way more successful. So you have quite the resume in the history. So you were at Frog, you were at Fjord, you were at Magic Leap too. But I see your background was in computer science, but it seems like you've like dabbled in a lot of industrial design. Is that right?
So I had gone to school for computer science because I was a nerd for technology and everything technological. When I was a little kid, what I would do is I would open up a notepad and I would create a user story of how someone would use an operating system that was not DOS, you know, so like a command line interface, but it was like a new way, like a new operating system. So I was doing user flows before user flows were even a thing. I was just doing them on Windows 3.1 and talking about like what I wanted DOS to be one day. But I think coming from computer science was very beneficial for me to go into design, UX design specifically, because the whole relationship and attributes thing, I was using that in my design work from the very beginning, because I saw the power of the relationship of objects in design work, especially complex design work, very early on. And so at Frog, they put me on the hardest kind of B2B problems, because they said, okay, you seem to understand complexity. You're a systems thinker. So go and think through these systems. Now that I'm kind of walking through the course and I'm like, oh, like Sophia is so much smarter than me, because she understood that you needed to go into this level of detail when you're talking about objects versus nested objects, and this level of detail when you're talking about core content versus metadata. And I would say that like everything in my career was really focused around technology. And then I did not know, nor was it really kind of named design back then. And I've kind of grown up with design as design has grown up around me. And I just was the beneficiary of being born in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, I hear that. I hear that for sure. And thank you for saying that you think I'm so smart. I sometimes think that the reason I created this process is because I'm not so smart. And like, I'm like, some people can just do this in their head and create good design and like, just do it naturally. I'm like, no. I need a process to do this, to take all of the complexity that is being put in front of me. I need to visualize this in a way. And I was trying, visualizing it in screen design was just not really working very well. It was just creating so much rework and just a lot of just too much work. You know, it was that really that rework of like, I was doing so much guesswork by trying to figure this stuff out in screen design and like doing that multitasking where I'm figuring out requirements and data structure while I'm doing layout and UI, and correct. I can't do both at the same time. There's probably people out there that can do both at the same time. More power to you. I can't do that. I cannot do that. I'm not smart enough to do it.
I probably had the ego to think that I could have done that in my 20s, you know, when I was coming out of school and I first started as a program manager at Microsoft and then moved into design later. I probably thought of myself as like able to kind of hold all this complexity in my head. Now, I think I've realized now that like our digital systems are so complex and just getting more and more complex every single day, because this is the demand of technology. As technology starts to grow, complexity starts to grow, and the human brain is not going along with us. So people who create processes to help us to kind of tame that complexity all the way through, it's helpful to all of us, even those people who are wunderkind and can keep it all in their head. I don't know who those people are, but God bless them.
Yeah. Even if you can't keep it all in your head, you still have to communicate it to people and work with other people that maybe didn't have 40 hours to go through the complexity. They need to understand it in 2 hours. So like you have to have some way to visualize that. So to your point, maybe it's like I got away with doing it without OUX back in 2010, 2011, 2012. And And now just stuff has escalated so much.
Correct.
It's like, I can't get away with not doing this as much. And I think that people still are creating good design without this process. It's just, maybe they could have done it more easily.
A little bit better. Or easier.
A little bit better, and like, or a little bit easier, a little bit less time, a little bit less money with this process.
And you come from consulting, as do I. And in consulting, like, clients are becoming more and more demanding. They want results mm-hmm. faster. And the idea that a process can help us to get to a better understanding faster and a more complete understanding and be able to communicate that across a large organization where that understanding might not be shared, organizations really value that. And if you are interested in doing consulting and design, this is amazing for your toolkit because you will look even more like a superstar than at someplace like HelloFresh.
It's really exciting seeing some of the folks that have gone through the program that are consultants, independent consultants, and they are starting, I'm hearing more and more that people are getting inundated with OOUX specific job requests. And that is just like, that is success right there, that other folks are having success and getting people literally lining up where they can't handle all the requests. Like, that is just, it's so amazing that it's because people are seeing that it works in this area where you just have to get a bunch of stakeholders together.
Yeah.
We'll probably end up talking about scope too.
Well, as
pretty
part
important
of that,
with consulting, getting your scope clear.
One thing that I have done, other than just like being the VP of design and research at HelloFresh, I advise startups on design and design, like hiring and growth, especially like pre-revenue startups. And the conversations that I'm having are to like, here is a methodology, OOUX, that helps you to get things done more efficiently and more completely. And now we're having discussions all around, like, what is the correct org model? Because I think a lot of people walk in with a lot of assumptions that I need a kind of full stack product team, you know, that I need a product manager and a UX designer and a UX researcher and a UI designer. And when you walk in with a methodology to these really smart founders that want to do things very efficiently and save money, now all of a sudden they're saying, we're going to scrap this plan of four different people as part of this product team, you know, the product and design team. We're going to rethink what our job requirements are going to be. And then we're going to create OOUX job descriptions, and we're going to rethink all of this stuff.
Hey, y'all. Sophia from the future popping in here to remind any PMs or POs listening that I am offering you a 10% discount on the OOUX Masterclass, whether that's just for you or you are signing up your team. If it's just for you, go to OOUX.com/masterclass. And if you want to take a look at the discounts and the bonuses that you get when you sign up a team, go to OOUX.com/team cohorts. And when you check out, use the discount code What's the discount code? OOUXPM10. And this is going to expire on May 15th, 2023. Okay. So, and if you're not a PM or a PO, maybe you should share this episode. Share this episode with your PM/PO. Okay. Let's get back to the combo.
Oh my God. That's so exciting. And I think we'll probably get into this. Well, let's get into it, because the reason that we're talking right now is, one, I'm really interested in how OOUX is playing out at HelloFresh, but also sure. We got into a conversation because I sent out a newsletter recently where I was like, let me be the 5 millionth person to talk about the difference between UX and UI design. So I just like, you know, added my thoughts to that dumpster fire of a conversation. You replied to that and had some really interesting thoughts about how, like, the way that I was defining UX was starting to sound like product management. Right. And then we got into this conversation about like, ooh, like, there's a difference between UX versus UI, which is interesting. But what about the difference between UX versus product management? Like, maybe that's even... they're both really interesting conversations, but maybe that's a conversation we should also be having, which doesn't seem like that's as much of a conversation. There's a lot of talk on UX versus UI, and I just, you know, I'm adding my thoughts to add fuel to that fire. But this conversation between the difference between UX versus product management, and at HelloFresh, you call them product owners, right?
Yeah, we're switching back between these names, but yeah, product owners, product managers. Yeah.
Okay. So I went to ChatGPT to ask the difference between a product manager and a product owner, and there were slightly different definitions there. But I think for the purpose of this conversation, can we agree that a PM and a PO is interchangeable?
Yes. For this conversation, absolutely. Let's do that.
Okay. I think that there is nuance there, at least according to artificial intelligence. And I looked at some job descriptions also on LinkedIn, and there seems to be a little bit of difference. But let's just say for now that let's not debate the difference between PM versus PO, because
we might not be qualified.
So we'll lump those together. So apologies, and would love to hear, get us on Twitter. So I'm Sophia VUX. What's your Twitter?
Jake Z.
Ooh, early.
I came in hot and early on that one.
Yeah. So easy Twitter handle. So if you do have ideas on the difference between PM and PO, love to hear that. We're going to be talking about how UX and PM might be getting a little bit mushy there. So thoughts on glomming those together?
Yeah. I think the UX UI discussion actually happens because of the lack of clarity between product managers and UX designers.
So this is all one discussion, basically.
It's all one discussion. I'll tease it out. I'm a systems designer. We'll tease it out a little bit.
Yes,
but
please.
Like for me, whenever I read descriptions about what a product manager is supposed to be, especially a good product manager, I see a lot of jack of all trades. They're supposed to be the jack of all trades. And to me, jack of all trades means the doer of many things, but the master of none of those things. Mm-hmm. And that to me, actually, weirdly, holding that as a badge of honor is weird to me. Like it sounds like very regressive language, because if I walk into a corporate environment where we're all trying to be T-shaped, right? We're trying to be broad enough and deep in one field. If I come in and say I'm a jack of all trades, I actually don't have any depth. And that seems contrary to kind of how corporations want us to form ourselves as part of, learning and growing in the context of doing work. And so for me, this really does feel like the equivalent of what a webmaster was in the 90s, right? They were the jack of all trades on a website, provisioning the server, they're setting up self-hosting, they designed it, they probably coded it, they maintained it. But and maybe they did the analytics for it, whatever that little counter was on our websites, on our GeoCity websites, I guess that was the analytics.
Yeah.
But really, we've moved away from the webmaster role because we saw that the jack of all trades system makes sense. So instead of a webmaster provisioning and setting up the server, we're using things like AWS or fly.io to kind of provision these things. So certainly when it comes to coding, we don't have webmasters doing that. We have engineers, and we've gone further and said there's a differentiation between front-end engineering and back-end engineering, and sometimes even further to say you are a React native engineer. So it goes into deep specialization there. And then certainly for maintaining the website, we're talking about how we have specialized folks in ops now. And it's their sole job to work on the operations, the maintainability, and the security of these websites. But for design and product, this is where UX design specifically and product, this is where it gets funny, because they both seem to be caring about the same thing, but they approach it from, I think, different success metrics. So the UX designer approaches it from a success metric of, let's go for something very easy, like task completion or task enjoyment. And a product manager would go same way, but they would say, I have a certain KPI that I care about for the business, like a conversion rate or an average order rate. And they're trying to juice that metric. So the way that I say this at work is the UX designer cares about the user and the business in that order, and the product manager cares about the business and the user in that order. And I'm fine with that. The problem is that sometimes we get confused about who is designing for the user. We're all designing for the user. And what ends up happening is the product manager is kind of doing half the UX process. The UX designer is doing the half that they're allowed to do in the process. And they don't meet together. They don't have a clean point together. And then we get bad design work. And I want to fix that, because what we end up saying then is, okay, the UX designer is not just UX designer. Now they're a UX UI designer. Okay. Now you've given me tasks that will fill out the rest of my day. And those tasks might not actually be the skill set that I have or that I'm good at or I find passion in.
Yeah, that is such a good way to put it. Is it's like we have this, it's like we're trying to do the same thing, but it's just that those KPIs are different. And no wonder teams are confused. And sometimes like a senior level UX designer might feel like they're stepping on PM toes, and then a PM might not actually feel like they're supposed to be advocating for the user, but that's the UX designer's job. And there is a lot of, there's so much overlap there.
In those cases, you know, where the UX designer is very strong and the PM has put into a weakened position, then all of a sudden their job is like the human embodiment of a JIRA ticket, which is not good at all, right? Mm-hmm. And so we need these roles to cooperate together because they have two different lenses to solve the same problem, and getting those lenses kind of all in the same room, you know, like feedback's a gift, and the more that we can design as a community, the better off our users are going to be. I just need now for product managers to understand they don't even have to like do the process. They need to understand the Orca process that we're doing and understand OUX enough so that everyone is kind of working along the same path towards this very good user benefit at the end.
So one other way I've heard this described, so my, certified OUXer, and a friend of mine, Lauren, and I was having this similar conversation, and she was really pushing back on some of my ideas that potentially the senior UX designer that really understands the business is your PM.
Maybe. I don't know. I do feel like everyone thinks that there's a dead end in the design career and that eventually one day they have to grow up and be PMs. And I don't see it. You know, like I don't get it.
Potentially, though, if PM gets a little bit redefined on what the actual roles and responsibilities are of the PM, because I feel like in the industry, a lot of folks are not seeing the PMs that they're working with. And I'm sure that there's so many gajillions of really amazing, really, really beneficial PMs out there doing great work. But there is a sense that PMs are extraneous sometimes, that like, what are these people doing? They're just, it's a lot of that kind of like almost feeling like fake work. And this is just, I'm just the messenger. Yeah. This is what I've been hearing. And I think that, you know, from some of the notes we went back and forth on, like, you're hearing some of the same buzzing.
Correct.
Of where like PMs are just kind of, this like glorified JIRA ticket, human version of JIRA ticket that kind of shuffles everything around. So what Lauren said is, she said the product manager is the the PO is the person that's defining the what, and then the UX designer and the UI designer define the how. And I don't agree, actually. I think that might be like how it is today, but I think the person that really understands the user and is the advocate for the user should be the one defining the what. And that what, and again, this is maybe a bunch of semantics and role definitions, but that what to me is so much of what Orca is. Like, that to me defines the what. That is like, if you can take two different companies that are competitors, if they have the exact same O's, R's, and C's and A's, the exact same O's, R's, C's, and A's, just manifested differently with different UI and different design system and different branding and different voice and tone, like, that's going to be hard competition right there.
Correct.
It's going to be really difficult for an end user to decide, like, do I go with X or do I go with Y? Where you differentiate, where you decide what this actually is, it's figuring out, well, what are your objects? How do those objects relate to each other? What can people do to those objects? And what attributes, what information do those objects hold? And again, like, I'll say it again, if you have the exact same of those, like, good luck competing. You're going to be competing. It's going to be like on how fast you're, like, it's going to be competing on, I don't want to say commodity, but like, it's going to be competing on how good your technology runs, how good your customer service is. how good your UI is, and all those things are really, really important to the overall experience. But somebody could catch up with you real quick on some of those things. But like catching up on how your data is housed and how what people can do to that data is, I think, a bigger differentiating factor. So if the PM/PO is the one defining the what, but they're not doing Orca, like I feel like this could even elevate what a PO or a PM does by using or at least facilitating or encouraging this process of defining these things, these kind of pillars of the Orca process.
Yeah, no shade to Lauren, you said, right?
We love, yeah, no, and I think think that I would say to Lauren that like she is saying what I think is true right now. I think this is absolutely true about our industry. This is what a PM does and what a UX, but I don't know if that's what it should be.
Yeah, let's talk about this in terms of like a service blueprint. Lauren is capturing the current state right now. And and what we're talking about right now is the North Star state. What I would say, no shade to Lauren, but like separating the what and the how does not seem like the right way to cleave this problem because of all of the things that you have brought up, right? Like it's a weird translation problem now. So now a lot of the problems that we're having is around like, what do you mean by this thing? And what do you mean by like these initiatives? And then the how is like, did you go out of your bounds or in your bounds for what I have set as the parameters of this discussion? I want both UX designers and product managers to be more strategic. And these discussions around like, not around what we're doing for customers, but like how we're cooperating together, unfortunately devolves both of us into tactics. Mm-hmm. And then we have the human embodiment of the Jira ticket on the left-hand side, my PM, and I've got the human embodiment of a pixel pushing Figma designer on the right-hand side. And that's not beneficial. And no one's happy with the work. No one's happy with the consequences and the outcomes. So let's talk about the North Star state. In the North Star state, I don't care whether your title is product manager. I don't care if your title is UX designer. There are a number of things that customers, there's an amount of complexity that we are putting upon customers as part of the digital products and services that we need to deliver for them. Because, you know, we want to make revenue. We want to do things that will meaningfully affect and help people's lives. And we should be doing that efficiently and completely for them. Mm-hmm. And if you're a product manager and you decide to take the OUX course and then you start using the Orca process as part of your work, no one's going to blame you. No one's going to be like, get out of my lane, product manager. Like, this is UX work. Much like we would say for the UX designer, if you care about like the business outcomes, no one's going to say like, get out of my lane. Like, good design work from the very fundamental, like the best design work is where the user needs and the business needs. I'm doing a Venn diagram with my hands over the video right now. Yeah. The user needs and the business needs completely overlap, right? That's where it's easy. And so then as if we all kind of learn or at least learn how to cooperate within this process of discovery and identification and acknowledging the complexity of these systems, then I think we all just do better work for our customers. Forget the titles. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, I see it like, because if you have these people, these people in a room, and they're working through an object map together, there is the person that's good at facilitating. That might be the PM. That might be the UX designer. The person that's good at like standing up there, facilitating the work happening. And then you have the person that really needs to understand the business objectives. Like that person needs to be in the room. And the person that understands the competitive landscape and the person that understands the high level goals of where the business is going, where the organization is going, like high level roadmap, the vision, right? Like that person needs to be in the room. There also needs to be the person in the room that really understands what the users are struggling with in a current state. If there is a current state, what the users are asking for, a customer service representative is great to have, or like a customer support manager, like amazing. A salesperson, if you have sales folks, like they're amazing to have in the room too, because they know what people are asking for. They know what people are like disappointed that doesn't exist in the product. Like those people just need to get in a room together, and whoever is facilitating it, like, I don't know, just the person that likes facilitating the most can facilitate that. Yeah. And then own that, like the figuring out what are the things and how do they connect to each other and what can people do. I'm just like a broken record, but like figuring all that out together and getting on the same page. And like you said, like acknowledging the complexity, and you're nodding your head. So I feel like we're on the same page about this. I have another conversation that I just had this weekend with a dear friend of mine, and something that she's dealt with a whole lot in her life is this idea of like coming, like a PM giving a requirement. In this case, I'll abstract it, but in this case, it was, okay, we're showing these analytics on stores and we need to show benchmark. So we're going to show benchmark analytics. So, you know, like, does your store have a lot of turnover or not enough turnover?
Yeah,
like
underperforming well, or overperforming.
Underperforming. Yeah. Yes, yeah.
Aspects.
And so gotcha. We need to. So can you go make that look good where we can see benchmarks as the UX designer? Like, that's your job. We need benchmarking. Doesn't matter where I got it from. I just think we need benchmarking. And my friend says, well, okay, one, where are we getting that data from? Like, how do we know what a benchmark is? Also, like, well, isn't it going to be dependent on the industry? Like, is this an Outback Steakhouse? Is this a Chipotle? Is this a Baskin Robbins in Michigan versus a Baskin Robbins in Florida? Like,
correct.
They might have different benchmarks. Like, where's all this information coming from? So the PM/PO was just wanting, like, show me the wireframes, show me what that's going to look like when we can see benchmark data. And she's asking these questions, where is this data coming from? How clean is this data actually? And some of that complexity on, well, how are we showing benchmarking, like based on different industry, based on location of these stores? Is it in a city? Is it rural? So she's asking all of these OOUX-y questions, right?
Right.
And you know what her PM tells her?
I'm afraid to know, but tell me.
You're overcomplicating it.
And I hear the
versions of this story over and over. The person that is like responsible for these requirements, if you will, these like, what does this product need to do? What does it need to display? The orca, basically. They might be not using those words, but really the orca. And then the UX designer gets this, has no idea the context, questions it, and gets told that they're overcomplicating it.
Yeah. I mean, the questions that they're asking are completely reasonable and rational. You make an excellent point of like, if I'm an ice cream shop, how do I benchmark myself if I have seasonality versus if I'm in a tropical environment? That is an incredibly straightforward question to ask. And I do, you know, when I get an answer that is essentially like, don't worry your pretty little head about it. I don't react very well to that at all. And usually what I end up saying is like, now you're on my bad side. And if you're on my bad side, now I'm going to go into like mega Jake systemic thinker mode. You wanted me to stop. And now I'm going to go to 200%, unfortunately. I usually find that this is not a design answer. This is a personality and kind of communication answer. I have found that like when folks say things like you're overcomplicating it, what they're actually saying is I don't have the answers for you and I'm in a vulnerable state right now and I should have the answers for you and now I'm feeling terrible. And this is the way in which they express that type of kind of self-effacing feeling. This is how they externalize it. From a design perspective, I mean, I will say that there are some times where we have decided to change the color of a button and now all of a sudden it's like we're painting the Mona Lisa. And so I would say in those cases, and I'm like, whoa, like where are we going with all of this? Mm-hmm. This is why I ask all of the designers, especially a little bit more junior designers, before you go and do a bunch of research, just think through what you want to accomplish first and then say, like, write down like a task list of this is where I think I'm going to get the answers for these things. And then critique that as well, because you might be overcomplicating things. You might be undercomplicating things. You know, like there's ways in which even for the discovery process, even just like checking with a friend to make sure, is this going to get me what I think I'm going to, it's going to get me kind of thing. That's a good question to answer. I mean, your designer could be very passive aggressive and just do the stupid thing and just write like, okay, fine, this is what it's going to be, you know, number here, and then label benchmark, and then put another number. And, you know, like, you could do that passive aggressive thing. What I would say in these cases is, don't ever crap on someone for asking a rational question. You know, the correct answer is like, I need to get something out next week because we promised this to the business. And I didn't realize how complicated this question was until you started asking, or this task was until you started asking me questions. So I apologize, but like, can we go back a step and just like make a bunch of assumptions right now, knowing that we're going to, you know, redo these assumptions in the future.
Yeah.
I would say sometimes, you know, at HelloFresh, we have an experimentation culture, and that's great because our customers tell us what works and what doesn't work. It takes away the argument from people like me and puts the argument in the hands of our customers. The problem with it is that sometimes we have to, in order to experiment with something, we have to do a level of change because of a complexity that wouldn't necessarily facilitate an easy test. And sometimes then all of a sudden we're like, no, you're making the test dirty. Like, we need to make the test clean. And that's another short way, like a shorthand way of saying like, please don't ask any more questions. Just design the thing I need you to design. Right. But we're working on that, you know, now that we're working on the communication aspects around experimentation.
That's such a good, like, grounded answer, grounded in reality answer of, yeah, sometimes you do have to work based on assumptions. It's just recognize those assumptions, agree that these are assumptions, maybe even look at those assumptions and say which ones are high risk and which ones are low risk. Like, sometimes you can design with assumptions. It's just, but we've said, like, these are all really low risk assumptions. Like, if we get this wrong, it's not going to be a huge deal. We just, and the best way to validate these assumptions, just get it out there and see how it works. And some assumptions, it's like, oh damn, like, if we get that out there, that's like super high risk. We'd really mess things up. And depending on what industry, you could like, fall out the sky, you know. Like,
benchmarks is kind of dangerous, right? Because you are putting business data in front of someone to help them to facilitate a business decision. And if you don't do that properly, and you don't contextualize that enough for a customer, like, this Baskin Robbins in Michigan is going to close. I'm going to tell you right now. And look, I love Baskin Robbins. I don't want it to close.
Yeah. And so I know it's been a while. I've been to a Baskin Robbins. But one thing I would also add to anybody that has been told you're overcomplicating it, and just to kind of echo what you said, is to say, all right, this is the assumption that I'm hearing, that if you're like, you want me to design on this assumption, which is totally fine. Pop it back to that person, PM, PO, whoever they are, design director, pop it back to that person and say, how high risk is this assumption? Is this a low risk assumption, or is this a high? And then you can force them to potentially say it's a high risk assumption, and that they are asking you to design based on high risk assumptions, which is
correct.
You know, we're just making sure that we're all on the same page here. Okay. Is that what you're asking me to do? All right, cool. I'm going to go do that thing. But
The other question we ask at HelloFresh is this a one-way door or a two-way door? So for example, when we're doing a brand change, that's a one-way door. And at that point, like, if you don't have like the details down for the brand, like, you have to live with this probably for another, I mean, we did our first brand, we lived it with it for 10 years. And so we have to live with this decision for 10 years. And so we take those. So if it's a one-way door, meaning that we can't go back, or if we go back, we would look incredibly weird, silly, stupid. We take those much more seriously.
Yes. Going back to that one-way door, two-way door, I feel like a lot of, like, getting your orca right, that is a lot of information architecture there. The C of the, like, all of those really are difficult to go back from. Like, changing it, like, if you get the object wrong. So I'm dealing with this with Mighty Networks right now, where Mighty Networks had topics and topics just changed to spaces.
Yes.
So literally they morphed one object into another object. And it was incredibly disruptive for me and from other hosts that I've talked to. It was a big, it was disruptive for them. It was a huge change that they knew they needed to make. And from talking to folks at Mighty Networks, they readily admit that they got the IA wrong. They got it wrong and then they needed to change something. Changing relationships, especially like from a technical standpoint, that can be a big lift. So like the more you can get that right, it's not completely a one-way door, but it's like those, it's that information architecture analogy that I give all the time that like, you don't want to iterate on where your walls and your plumbing are. You can, but it's going to be expensive. Iterating on like the arrangement of the furniture inside, cool. Like change your curtains, change out your furniture, even changing with that, like, oh, this was a bedroom and we're going to turn it into an office. Like, all right, cool. But you don't want to really be iterating so much because it's so expensive. Yeah. So getting that, really getting clear on your ORCA, you know, starting today, starting as soon as you possibly can. It's never too late.
Yeah. Why are you listening to this podcast? You should be doing ORCA right now.
Yeah. Come on. No, but stay with us and let's finish because I want to talk about
We got one more thing to say.
Yeah. So I do want to talk about prioritization and scoping because this feels like something that's so squarely on the PMPO side of like, what is the scope of this? What is the roadmap? Like where, what are we going to do first, second, and third? What are our priorities? And this is something that we do within the ORCA process. ORCA is great for scoping, figuring out exactly what are the edges of this thing. That's what the prioritization round is all about, which I know you're is ahead of you, but just any thoughts there on how like UX and PM/PO should be working together for scoping and prioritization and how ORCA potentially could help?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So the way in which we do prioritization at HelloFresh is called ICE, I-C-E. Have you heard of this before?
No, tell me more.
Okay. So it's not as cool as the cat and the red fire truck or whatever, but it is a acronym or initialism that stands for impact, confidence, and effort. And so the idea here is that the impact is kind of in dollars or in euros in HelloFresh's case, how much money that this thing is going to project to do if we do it well and right. The effort obviously is mostly around the technical effort, around the code and the changes we have to make. But the confidence is the number that has the least amount of science and the most amount of art around it. Yeah. And so I feel like as part of an ORCA process, we can ask those questions within prioritization to say, okay, for these bundle of changes we want to make, these bundle of user stories that we would say belongs to, let's just make up something like better understanding of discounts within HelloFresh. These bundle of user stories, we think that if we do this all well and right, that we can, you know, make this amount of money. For the most part, like, we can do a t-shirt sizing effort, but it's hard to know exactly what to do. But the confidence is we suspect that customers don't know all of this stuff. We suspect that customers would like to know more about their discounts. I think that's the point where we could say, okay, now maybe we have to go back and do a little bit more research, or maybe we can pull the research we already did and then bring that into the discussion. And that to me is actually a very clean discussion. We've only had messy discussions with PMs and UXers up to this point. That's now a clean discussion where the PM is saying, I've built the business case, and the UXer says, I'm building the confidence case for you on this.
Interesting. So this is like the cost benefit analysis with confidence added to it. It's like three axis. It's a three dimensional axis that you can play with. So you said, like, we're going to make this amount of money if we do this. That feels very squarely in PM realm. As a UX designer, I have not had to play in that. So that's like, I feel like there are things that are like, this is what the PM does that the UX designer does not have to necessarily worry about as much. And I think that just kind of like, you just spelled it out right there.
I think so.
Yeah. And then when it comes to that prioritization round where you're saying, okay, let's introduce these objects or work on these objects, like this relationship is more important than this relationship, et cetera. The PM can come in and have a little bit more of like how this is going to align to the business case. And while the UX designer is going to be thinking about how this is going to actually play out for the user, and then your developer also is going to come in with the E and say like, those two things don't talk to each other at all anymore. Like, we're going to have to write some APIs and some all the good stuff. So like,
correct.
And even content folks too. Like,
yes,
we
absolutely.
Don't have that
I mean,
content
you're doing
right
this correctly.
Now.
Yeah. Yeah. Content's everywhere. We need to
I shouldn't say even content
well.
Folks. I should say especially content.
Especially content folks.
Especially content folks. When you have a lot of content there, I mean, as an information architect, as a OOUXer, I can put a little yellow sticky note up for video underneath recipe for all of our 10,000 recipes. We're going to have video for that.
Oh boy, that little yellow sticky, whew, that has so much processing complexity. You're like, that sticky costs us, let me get the calculator, a lot of money.
Yeah, and a lot of time too. Like, okay, so in that prioritization, I right now we have kind of two lenses that we look at prioritization. It's the user needs versus the level of effort. And also we kind of are glomming in level of effort and confidence right now. So just to spell it out, if we've got a column in an object map, we might put video at the very top from a user perspective. Like when we have video, it's going to probably be near the top of the page because people are going to love it. So we'll have
Correct.
Video near the top, but correct. From a prioritization standpoint, we might tag that as phase three.
Correct.
Or we could also tag it as needs validation. So right now I'm combining that, and maybe that would be a good place to potentially separate it out by what would it make sense from a phasing perspective from the technology and also the business case, but then our level of confidence as well. How much do people even care about having video in there? We think they care, but we need more research to really validate that.
And what I would say is when we are on our best behavior at HelloFresh and we see something that could possibly have high impact, would probably have high effort, either from a technology side or a content production side, anything like that. And the confidence we have is I see other players doing it. This is my finger in the air. I've just licked my finger and I see other players doing this, but I don't know if they're getting, what they're getting out of it. Usually in those cases, what we will do is just do something. We have the benefit of scale at HelloFresh. So we can do something at a pilot level for a very specialized market, for a very specialized test that is live, and to see even if can we start to get just a little bit through experimentation of an uplift. Otherwise, I would say, very standard research techniques going in, not being assumptive about it and just saying okay, I'm going to show you something. I'm going to show you something else. And are you doing, I'm observing how you're acting on these pages. Are you doing the things I need you to do? Are hypotheses correct around this, for this specific thing around video? Are you engaged more? Do you take this recipe more? Is this somehow more delicious to you? Is this recipe easier to you? Perception stuff around that.
Have you had a point where going through and using OOUX, you've been able to identify some of those assumptions that have gone back to research where you realize this is a thing that we didn't think about before, and this can be turned into questions to go back to research?
100%. When thinking about ways in which customers kind of view their orders, take their orders and figure out what's in their box, we had a whole new way of orienting someone to that was more user-friendly or what we thought was user-friendly. So we've been thinking about beyond just subscriptions. So beyond meals in a box as part of a subscription, where can HelloFresh extend itself, in different kinds of products, services, types of products that you put in the box. And when you think about how the HelloFresh service can expand to lots of different areas, we don't just have to deliver meals in a box. We can deliver lots of things in a box. The fundamental assumptions that we have in our system start to get questioned, because the idea, sometimes executive management will just say the word just in describing something. Oh, it's like HelloFresh. It's just, we're going to do blah, blah, blah. And I've noticed that if someone uses the word just, that's their way of hiding a bunch of complexity. Mm-hmm. And so when you hear the word just, you say, that's a warning sign. They just said just. So now I'm going to unpack that a little bit and then design that. So this is exactly where I'm going, because where HelloFresh says we are weekly meal box delivery company, we might change that in some other fundamental ways about like what we deliver or how fast, you know, how frequently we deliver. That has made us start to question some of the fundamentals that we have had in the system, because there it is so ingrained in ourselves that we're a subscription company, we get a weekly box and it has meals in it, that if you don't think through all the complexity and then don't reevaluate all of that through this kind of re-object requirements thing that we're doing, it can get real messy real quick.
So what I'm hearing is, and I've often like thought of like a lot of those assumptions that get identified and get put back to research are kind of more like the devil in the details assumptions.
Correct.
This is sounding like some big ticket assumptions are kind of going back to research through this process.
Some devils are bigger than others. Yeah, some devils are bigger than others.
Yes. The devil could be in the overall product plan.
Yeah.
But yeah, it sounds like you're using this as a tool for potentially innovation.
Exactly right. Or certainly like when we go through an innovation sprint and we're thinking about a new product or service, the immediate next step after it gets sign off from executive management to say like proceed with this, but before it gets full funding, we definitely go into an OUX sprint at that point.
Ah, that's so awesome to hear. So I've already taken like, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you? That is the question. So before we wrap up is we're going to have to do a part two. I feel like I say this a lot, but like, maybe in a few months after y'all get even further with the masterclass. And like, I just want to really get into like looking at how this plays out. Like, how does it actually play out at HelloFresh? Like just being a fly on the wall and getting into the details. But is there anything else you want to leave folks with before we wrap up here? Anything else you want to say about OUX at HelloFresh?
Look, I love feedback and I love attention. So if you hit me up on Twitter at Jake Z. My Instagram is jake.zukowski. If you can't spell it, find me on Twitter. You can go to my Instagram.
We'll put the links in the show notes.
Thank you. Link in the show description. Find me on LinkedIn. Let's open up a discussion. And I've mentioned before, I love advising early stage startups and pre-revenue startups. So if you are a pre-revenue startup and you're trying to figure out how design fits into your org model in the most effective way, hit me up. I would love to lend a hand.
And tell us about your podcast.
Oh,
you have a podcast.
Well, so I used to have a podcast a long time ago. Yeah,
okay.
I was doing podcasting before it was cool. So my podcast was from 2011. It was called To Say the Least, It's an Internet Game Show. Because if you haven't gotten from my voice, kind of got game show host a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
But we could play To Say the Least when I reboot it.
Okay. Okay. Yes. Yes. I'm gonna go and do some internet digging and find it. Probably won't be that hard to find, but
probably not.
Yes. I can.
But I'm already embarrassed.
Game show host, like I feel like the Orca process is so game-like in so many ways.
Is.
Like it's just like Tetris and facilitating, like being like up, like facilitating a nested object matrix. I kind of feel like a game show host a little bit.
Yeah.
So maybe this is another reason why it resonates with you.
I think all system designers that were consultants have two things in common, right? They've all created games and they've all, you know, they're good at hosting games, right? And explaining the games. So I am always the family throws the rule book at me, and then it's my job to translate the rule book into something rational for everybody. I think you're the same way in your family.
I want an OUX game board, board game rule books.
Yeah, I would love it.
Yeah,
I'd play it.
It's all very linear. It's all very procedural. Those rule books of like, just tell me what these pieces are. How do they interact with each other? What can I do to them? And what are the different states of them? And then I can understand the game a little bit better. So.
Yeah.
That'll be for part two. Jake, thank you so, so much. We will be continuing this conversation and just, happy OUXing.
Thank you, Sophia. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing.